Dean and run the yeshiva known as Darchei Noam and a women's seminary academy known as Midrashet Rachel. Both of them, professionally, are also known as Chattels, and they are programs for men and women to come and study in Israel. Rabbi Kolinsky has developed a whole series of programs, actually, to bring people to Israel on short-term programs. There are executive learning programs, which are actually open to people of all ages. There aren't that many academies such as his in Israel that offer that as an option. People can go for short terms if you're in Israel for a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, etc. You have the option of being able to immerse yourself in some kind of a full-time learning experience through the various institutions that he runs. And we are fortunate to be able to have Rabbi Kolinsky visit Northern California, not quite every year, but often, and he's spoken at the Feast of Jewish Learning at Bat Yam in the past, and he's been hosted by Emek Bracha and by other venues, and it's really a privilege to be able to have Rabbi Kolinsky with us. I know that the topic of tiger moms and Torah moms is something that certainly strikes some sort of chord with a lot of people. I remember when New York Times was covering it, it was the talk of the town. So it's really a privilege to be able to have Rabbi Kolinsky with us to share his insights on this topic.
Thank you very much. Does everybody have a source sheet? That's the first thing. Everybody's read about the tiger mom? Did she make, how many of you did she make feel very, very insecure? Nobody? So if she didn't make you feel insecure, why are you here? What problem am I here to solve? You what?
I walk with her.
You think she's right?
Of course.
Uh-huh. Okay. Anybody think she's not right?
I've only sort of read what other people have said or found in some articles. Could you, you know, if we're going to set up an opposition, could you start with a summary?
I'm not going to set up an opposition, but we have here an article that she wrote for the Wall Street Journal. I'm not sure how many of you saw that. I think it was quite a interesting summary, although it made it sound even worse than the book was. If somebody read the whole book, it's a little tempered, but she says that her children were never allowed to attend a sleepover, never had a play date, never could be in a school play, never could complain about not being in a school play, they could never watch TV or play computer games, they could never choose their own extracurricular activities. They could never get any grade less than an A. Kids were told A minus is not an acceptable grade. And they had to be number one of the student in every subject except gym and drama. They could not play any instrument other than the piano or violin. And they could not play the piano or violin. Okay? Some Western parents consider themselves strict when they make their children practice their instruments for 30 minutes every day. That's strict. An hour, like that's, right? For a Chinese mom, the first hour is the easy part. It's after 2 or 3 hours that it gets tough. If you want to hear the real extreme, and then this is what probably, this is some of the stuff that really created some of the controversy. The 7-year-old daughter is working on a very complicated piano piece, and it requires a coordination of two hands, and the girl just couldn't do it. We worked on it nonstop for a week, drilling each of her hands separately. Whenever we tried to put the hands together, one always morphed into the other. It wasn't working. Lulu, that's the name of the girl, announced in exasperation she's giving up, and she stomped off. Get back to the piano now, I ordered. You can't make me. Sound like your kid? Yes, I can. Sound like you? All right, anyway, the girl tore up the piano piece. There was a rebellion. Anyway, so the husband who's watching this says, like, you know, step back, lay off. you know, you're pressuring her too much. And the Chinese mom says, you don't believe in her. And the husband says, of course I do. And the mom says, well, our older daughter played the piece when she was this age. And the husband says, but Lulu and Sophie are different people. Sound like a good dialogue? And then here's the Chinese mom's response. Oh no, not this, I said, rolling my eyes. Everyone is special in their own special way. I mimic sarcastically, she says. Even losers are special in their own way. Okay, that's one of the things. Losing isn't an option if you're a child of a Chinese mom. Anyway, so she says, I'm going to make her do it. You can be the nice guy. I'm going to take all the flack. I rolled up my sleeves, went back to Lulu, used every weapon, and then here's where we get to some stuff that is really, according to many psychologists, quite abusive. I threatened her with no lunch, no dinner, no presents. Okay, and then she said, I hauled Lulu's dollhouse to the car, and I told her I'd donate it to the Salvation Army, piece by piece, if she didn't have the piece perfect by the next day.
Well, I would say that's a little extreme. Aha.
Uh-huh. But only a little. How do they get? I'm sorry. Are you asking that as a rhetorical question? You have an answer, or are you? Okay. Before we get to, we're going to see some Jewish sources soon. But how do you get buy-in?
Well,
I have a friend who said, you know how you get buy-in? Because next time you give the whole dollhouse away at once. Why piece by piece?
Yeah. It's not a perfect association, but many Asian and non-Asian families in the rest of the world sleep with their infant children. The baby always has what a baby wants, mom, all the time. And they sleep with their parents, especially mom, until they're 3, 4, 5, or 6. And even then, after that, they sleep with another adult. So they're never alone. But to me, the child then grows up with a positive sense of identification with the parent, and babies and children are indulged in this culture. And given to the little ones, given whatever they want, and they're strict with the older kids. Asians looking at our culture think we have it bad backwards.
Are you sure that that's correct? What
my
you said.
That they
indulge the kids when they're little?
Indulge babies.
Ah. Okay, let me read another piece from the Wall Street Journal article, because I think this is going to highlight a couple of issues that we're going to talk about. Again, when we're going to contrast, and if you're looking for some of the sources of it. Chinese parents demand perfect grades because they believe their children can get them. If the child doesn't get it, the Chinese parent assumes it's because the child didn't work hard enough. That's why the solution to substandard performance is to excoriate, punish, and shame the child. The Chinese parent believes their child will be strong enough to take the shaming and to improve from it. And when the Chinese kids do excel, there's no ego-inflating parental praise lavished in the privacy of the home. If we want to understand one of the reasons why this did resonate with some people on some level, it's because when you American children tested for math scored way, way down on the totem pole of world high school kids in their math ability. Okay? That was one thing that they measured. Then they measured another thing. How well do you think you know math? Where do you think the American kids ranked on that one? Almost at the top of the charts. Okay, so look at this anomaly. right, where does it come from? It comes from the worry about self-esteem. 2 + 2 = 5. Johnny, that's so wonderful. You tried so hard. That was a very creative answer. Okay? So there's this contrast. Let's read on. Chinese parents believe that their kids owe them everything. This is why I'm not sure that your contrast between younger kids and older kids is 100% the explanation. But let's read on. Okay. The reason is unclear. It's a combination of Confucian filial piety and the fact that parents have sacrificed and done so much for their children. Chinese children must spend their lives repaying their parents by obeying them and making them proud. One more line, if I may. I'm going to find it quickly. Chinese mothers say they believe their children can be the best students. Now listen to the next sentence, because this is very important. That academic achievement reflects successful parenting, and if children did not excel at school, then there was a problem, and parents were not doing their job. What does that say? That sounds to me like I'm looking at my child and I need to validate my successful parenting by how the child is doing. And if the child isn't doing good, it reflects badly on me. Okay? Okay, good. Now let's shelve that and see some of our sources. Take your source sheet, please. We're going to start with the first source on the back of the first page. This is the verse in Mishlei, in Proverbs, upon which everything is going to be based. The verse says, Chanoch lana'ar al pi darko, educate, and we'll see that I have in parentheses the word consecrate. We'll see in a minute where that came from, because the word Chanoch in Hebrew has a number of meanings. It's a multi-leveled word. But the simple translation is educate the lad according to his path, and when he grows old, he will not deviate from it. So the first thing we have in source number 2, 3, and 4 is the translation of the word chanoch. Chanoch, says the commentator on Mishlei, the Mitzudat Zion, refers to the initiation of something that will continue. And he quotes a verse from the Torah, right, that Asher bana bayit velo chanacho, a person built a home or a house and did not inaugurate it or consecrate it. In other words, it's preparing something for a continued process or activity. So chanoch means I am going to prepare the child for what he or she is going to be doing down the road. And then source 3 and 4 has another example of the word in a completely different context, and Rashi explains that that word, chanichav or chanoch, refers to Eliezer, who he initiated in mitzvot. The word is initiated. It is a language, I'm in source number 4 in the English, it's a language of inauguration of a person or a tool to a craft which he will maintain. So when we talk about chanoch, when we talk about educating a child, we're talking about preparing the child for activities that they are going to be doing in the future. Okay, that's what we mean by educating. So we're looking to the future. Source number 5, we'll do these in English. I assume that's going to be easier for everybody. All right, the Hebrew is available for those of you who want to follow. So says the Malbim, late 19th century, early 20th century commentator. Educate the lad according to his way. It is commanding two things. A, that the lad be educated. Accustom him from a young age to completeness, whether in intellectual matters or actions, meaning mitzvot, commandments, to the ritual behaviors, or personality traits, ethics, patience, initiative, not to be hedonistic, delayed gratification, what we call midot, character traits. For the habits that he acquires when he is young will make a habituated and lasting impression on the personality, which will not be lost even in old age. So according to this, the explanation is educate the child properly when he's young, and he will become habituated to it, and it will last throughout his life. Education, this is in contrast to if he or she doesn't get it when he's young, then education at an older age does not create lasting habits, and it will wane in old age. In other words, if the child is already much older when you try to educate them, then the habits are going to go away. We'll see in a minute a little deeper understanding of that. So the first thing is, educate the child when they're young into good habits, into good behaviors, into good character traits. Be, because there's another word in the verse. Educate the young child, al pi darko, according to his path. What does that mean? Says the Malbim, it is commanding that the education be according to his path. For every person has a different natural tendency. In intellectual matters, where one person has a sharp mind, while another has a smooth way of thinking, I translated it from the Hebrew, it means, you know, very logical as opposed to creative, what they call linear thinking. Not everybody has linear thinking, okay? Even among the men, okay? While another has a smooth way of thinking, each one must be educated according to the foundation that he has. That's in intellectual matters. In actions, one is naturally prepared for a certain craft, a profession. There are natural abilities. Some people are great with their hands. Some people are great with their minds. Some people are strong. Some people are musical. So, one is naturally prepared for a certain craft and a specific personality trait, and he will assimilate training for it easily. This is identified in the lab by his passion, by his enthusiasm, and according to what he strives for himself in something unique, you must educate him according to his path and according to the tendencies and towards his natural inclination. For then he won't abandon it when he grows old. This will not be the result if he is educated against his nature. Let's just run to source 6 to build on this. The Vilna Gaon. Everyone has heard of, hopefully, of the Vilna Gaon, the Gaon of Vilna. Source number 6. Educate when he is still a lad, then when he grows old, he will not deviate. Because a person cannot break his path, meaning his nature with which he is born. As we are taught, one who is born under the constellation of Jupiter will be a righteous person. When one is born under a negative constellation, he is given free will to utilize the nature he's given to either be righteous or wicked. We are taught one who is born under the constellation of Mars will be a spiller of blood. So at first glance, a spiller of blood, that sounds good news or bad news? Bad news. Continues Ravashi, either a circumciser, a mohel, a person who performs circumcisions, is that a spiller of blood? Is that good news or bad news? He's doing a big mitzvah. So he could be a circumciser. He could be a ritual slaughterer, a person who slaughters the animal so the meat is kosher. Or he could be an armed robber. All of those people are spillers of blood. That's the natural tendency that he was born with, that personality. But it doesn't deprive him of free will. How is he going to use it? Is he going to use that personality positively or negatively? It mentions these three, says the Vilna Gaon, because his nature is to be a spiller of blood. But with his free will, he can choose which of these three he will be. Either a circumciser, and he is righteous, performing a positive commandment, or a ritual slaughterer who is average, because, you know, we could be vegetarians. So it's not a big mitzvah, but it's certainly a positive thing. Or he could be an armed robber, a wicked person, a spiller of blood, literally. This is what is meant, educate the lad according to his path. the path consistent with his nature is how you should educate him to do mitzvos. Okay? Then, when he grows older, he won't depart from it. Look at the next sentence. But if you force him against his nature, excuse me, now he will listen to you. Why will he listen to you? What did he say? You have the authority. You can give away the dollhouse to the Salvation Army piece by piece. So you can listen. But later, when your authority over him is removed, he will deviate from this path, for he can't break his nature. Does pressure work? Well, it certainly works in the short term. What about the long term? Well, many Chinese kids grow up to be very well-adjusted, healthy, talented people. Just as somebody who smokes 2 packs of cigarettes a day, drinks alcohol, gets 3.5 hours of sleep, could live to be 101. But that's an exception to the natural system. The natural system is if you smoke 2 packs a day, drink a lot of alcohol, eat high cholesterol foods, don't exercise, you're probably going to have some serious health problems by the time you're 50. And the fact that you point to a guy who did it and he's 80 or 90, he's an exception. Right? And therefore, we need to do research on all of the kids that were raised like this. And there's a big pool of research, both in the secular world as well as in the Orthodox religious world. And in general, it's exactly what the Vilna Gaon says. Kids who are pressured to do something become very rebellious kids. When you choke the child, he's rebellious. On the other hand, now it's just so that, you know, we need to make sure that we don't fall into the, you know, Western lackadaisical, everything is fine, no discipline, no standards. Kids who grow up with no rules and no structure and no discipline end up being kids who can't make decisions. They're aimless in life in general. Some of them are very creative, but most of them get very messed up. What we're arguing for here and what we're going to see over and over again in our sources is balance on the one hand and individuality on the other hand. You have to know your child. Okay, I'm going to go back and read you a few sentences in the articles on the Chinese mom about why it works and what is we can import from that in every interaction with our children in education, and I believe that's really why it works. Okay, but we have to know our child, and then the education has to be about the child. If you're listening here already, we sense that we're not educating for my ego, but we have to educate for the child's needs, because we have to know what the purpose of education is. So let me read you again just to contrast how we view it. Again, most of what I'm reading here, there are two sources. One is an article in the Wall Street Journal, and one is from NPR. Chinese model doesn't dwell on happiness, nor does it deal well with failure. Source number 7. So, source number 7 is the commentary of the Maharal of Prague, 16th century philosopher, ethicist, Kabbalist, halakhist. And this is his commentary on the last chapter of Pirkei Avot. In the last chapter of Pirkei Avot, the rabbis list 48 things by which one acquires Torah. Memchet dvarim sha'Torah niknet bahem. How do we as Jews, what are the personality traits and qualities we need to have to enable ourselves to be acquirers of God's divine Torah? And one of the 48 is simcha, joy. Says the Maharal, joy is a great virtue. When a person is joyous, he is in a state of completeness. When we think about the word simcha, the word simcha implies a wholeness, a completeness, an expansion. Through this, he can receive Torah, which is the completeness of man. In other words, when a person feels complete emotionally, he can then be ready to reach a higher level of completeness spiritually and intellectually. When a person is in distress, he is deficient and can't be a recipient of Torah, which is the completeness of man. The principle is that completeness in the transcendent spiritual realm, which is Torah, isn't possible without joy, which is a completeness in the human emotional dimension. Okay? So, while she says Chinese model doesn't dwell on happiness, Judaism says if we're not going to educate children to be happy, they're not going to be interested in Judaism. If they don't have a joy, if they're not excited, if they're not emotionally connected to the Judaism, then it's not going to take. And this is very obvious when anybody studies children who are abandoning Judaism, they're not interested in Judaism. It's usually because they don't associate with good experiences. Now, this woman writing the NPR article, it doesn't. She says, I'm on my living room couch when my 12-year-old daughter comes downstairs and announces that she's done enough reading for one day, and she's also practiced flute for 15 minutes. She was going to kick back and watch TV. So, she brings in a quote from Chua, the Chinese mom. Winning prizes gives you opportunities. That's freedom. We want freedom. I want to do what I want. So the Chinese mom says, if you're tops in something, then you have freedom. Okay? So this woman writes, I looked over at my daughter, had mixed feelings about her just chilling out in front of the TV rather than plugging away in that virtuous circle of enforced practice. So how do you think it ended? She made a practice or she just gave in? I guess we won't be sending out invitations for Carnegie Hall anytime soon. Okay? So there's this idea of expertise, mastery gives you freedom. One of the points that she does make, we want to have fun. But you can't have fun if you're not good at something. People have fun at computer games because they're good at computer games. You can't have fun playing piano if you're not good at playing piano. So you want to work at becoming good at something so that you can have fun. But you got to be good at it. Now, what do we want to be good at? And here we come back again to the earlier sources that we had. Depends on the personality, depends on the tendencies. Not everybody is cut out to be a concert pianist. So what happens if I'm not? Well, you've got to know your child and make sure that your demands are appropriate for the child and that your demands aren't built on what the neighbors are going to say or the ego that I'm going to be building. Source number 8. Please. A teacher of young children. This is a commentary on this verse. A teacher of young children who finds that some of the children are much sharper than the others, and he sees there's no way they can study together, with the sharper ones needing their own teacher, because if they're all in one class, the quick ones are going to pull down the slow ones. The slow ones are going to pull down the quick ones, and if we educate the quick ones, the slow ones are going to be lost. So what do we do? So he says he should not remain silent. He should tell their parents that these need one teacher and those need another teacher. And even if he will lose income if they're separated, because in those days, the teacher got paid by how many kids he had in his class. So if I've got 15 kids and half of them aren't appropriate for the class and I give them away, I'm only going to get paid for 8 instead of 15. But I got to do that because I'm shortchanging the children if I try to educate everybody the same. Educate, continues the Sefer Hasidim, educate the lad according to his path. Also, when he grows old, he will not deviate from it. If you see he will succeed in Chumash, but not in Talmud, don't pressure him to study Talmud. And if he understands Talmud, don't pressure him to study Chumash. What he understands is what you need to teach him. Who are we focused on? The parent's ego or the welfare and the abilities and the needs of the child? Daughter Lulu, around 10, comes home one day with a bad grade on a math test. She said, "I hate math. I'm bad at math." I didn't accept that. I said, "I am making practice tests." This is the mother talking. And I hand wrote them, and I drilled them with her for a week. The next test, she did really well. And guess what? She decided she didn't hate math. And then her friends started calling her a math whiz. And now math is her favorite subject. I'm not sure if you picked up what just happened here. Because if we want to know one of the secrets of the success, it was in this little sentence. Kid comes home. She's not good at math. She hates math. What'd the mother do?
Help.
Who practiced?
Help. The mother is the child. Help.
Help.
Drill. Engage with the child.
Keep going.
Believe in the child.
But believe in the child. That's easy to believe in the child. She rolled up her sleeves. She, the mother, rolled up her sleeves, sat down, wrote tests, wrote drills, and then sat there and drilled the child over and over and over and over again. That's called investing in our children. How much time do we spend doing what they need to help them succeed? That, I believe, is something that we, too often as parents, are missing. We fob it off on the schools. We expect them to happen. We're very strict, but we're too busy to invest in the kids. Okay, and I think this is a lesson that we learned, which was alluded to in the Sefer Hasidim. We have to know what the kids need and make sure we pay the price, our price, to give the kids what they need so that they can succeed. Questions still here?
It's not so much a question as a comment. One thing that leaps out of these texts compared with the Chinese mom is these are imbued with values. The Chinese mom is about succeeding and gaining skills or succeeding academically and intellectually. I don't hear anything about if you cheated to get the top grade in class. If somehow...
No, I don't think...
As long as you brought home that
no,
top grade.
No, I don't think that's correct. I don't think that's correct. I think it's... You're right. I agree with the first part of what you said. It's about getting the skills. Cheating is not a skill.
This is a marriage of what kind of human being is that child going to be when they grow up, along with they have to live in a real world with a practical life and be able to support themselves and their families and have the skills they need to operate in the world.
And look
there's
at people.
There.
And let me build on what you're saying. And how do you think these kids look at people who aren't as talented as them? They look down at them, degrading. What's the value of the human being? Is the value of the human being in how well they know how to play piano or do algebra? Is that the value of the human being? Or is that a tool? Is that a skill? In other words, and here we're going to see this, you know what, let's read a couple more sources, and I think it'll help us round out the picture a little bit. Okay, so source number 9. Now we're going to see an 180-degree opposite perspective and interpretation of the text compared to what we've seen till now. It is written, "Educate the lad according to his path." Everybody see where I am in source 9? Asks the Reishi Chochma, "What is the path of a lad? What's the path of a little kid? To learn or not to learn? What's the path of a kid? Kid wants to learn. Your 5-year-old loves to learn. They love to do homework. They don't want to play computer games. They don't want to play basketball. They just want to sit and study. They have delayed gratification. When they're hungry and mommy's busy, they say, oh, that's fine, no problem, I have patience." Somebody has kids like that? Without being educated, that's their natural...
Kids like to learn. It's not a punishment. I'm not learning. It's not a book.
Okay, learning is an end form. Okay.
When the kid is hungry and you're busy, is the kid's natural reaction to say, "Oh, mommy's busy. I better wait quietly." Anybody have anybody still remember with babies? Right, you know, your baby's crying for the bottle, and you're doing something very important, and you tell the baby, "Have a little patience. I'll be back in 20 minutes." "Oh, mommy's going to come back in 20 minutes. Fine, I'll sit there quietly."
No, you pick up the baby.
I understand. And a 6-year-old kid?
You give it what it is. I realize
says the Reishi Chochma. What is the path of a lad? To not learn, to not daven, to waste time, to pursue drives for pleasure, I would add immediate gratification. That's the path of a little child. If you leave him on that bad path, to the instinct of his immature nature, and you don't rebuke him to bring him to proper behavior, so then also when he grows old, he will not deviate from it. It's a 180-degree opposite interpretation of the verse. If you educate a lad according to his instincts, his natural way of doing things, meaning you just let him do things that come naturally, he's going to get into childish, immature habits. And I believe this is the result of this hands-off, lackadaisical education that our generation has seen in the last 20, 30, 40 years. Everything is okay, we just let him do whatever, or maybe I don't have time to educate him. And then they turn into demanding immediate gratification, self-centered, hedonistic adults. Because that's the nature of a child. But in a child, you know, a 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 year old doesn't know better. But if we let them just keep doing it and we don't educate them, so he's saying if you let him go along according to his path, when he grows older, he's going to be that same hedonistic, self-indulgent adult. As he grows old, he will not deviate from it because it has become his ingrained nature, and he will not be able to leave it. According to this, it doesn't mean that this is a commandment, educate the lad according to his path, but rather a warning. You educate this kid according to his path, he's going to stay that way. Okay, so this is a 180-degree opposite understanding, but it gives us a perspective. The child has to be educated, disciplined, delayed gratification, patience, kindness, sharing your toys. Right? Most kids don't like to share instinctively. They need to be taught. So this is what you were mentioning. What kind of a human being do we want to raise? Are we only educating for skills, or are we also educating for character traits, for qualities of our humanity? That's also important. And again, as parents, we also have to set, you know, I cannot imagine what picture a child has of authority when the threat is to give away the dollhouse piece by piece to the Salvation Army if you don't do what I tell you you have to do. Right? Now, again, it worked, and we have to ask what was the dynamic, and we'll talk about that maybe in a minute. But we certainly have to realize that, you know, our interactions with our children creates positive or negative impressions on the child. Let's see source number 10. When study and education to mitzvot and habits of good character traits become the child's nature when he is young, certainly in his old age he won't deviate from those characteristics, since what he is habituated to becomes his nature. This becomes even more part of his nature when his pursuits of physical pleasure cool down and he doesn't have such a drive for these things. In other words, we've got to educate habits now so that as the child becomes older and more mature, it becomes easier to behave properly. And then he uses the opposite interpretation, which is a contrast, but if you let the child just go according to their instincts, so then when they grow up, they're also going to act very instinctually, which is very selfish and very hedonistic. Okay? All right. Let's take some questions, and now maybe we're going to try to elaborate a little bit on this and see, you know, how with these second. Okay. Maybe I'll just add one other very important point. It was alluded to here a little bit, but I think it can't be overemphasized. The only way tough love can work, and at the end of the day, without tough love, you can't educate a child, because there are things that are tough. But what does tough love require? What's the most important word in that phrase, tough love? There has to be a truly loving relationship. Now, what does love mean from a Jewish perspective? I'm sure you've had a lecture on this. It's not possible you're coming to the Jewish Studies Network and not have a lecture on love. What is love from a Jewish perspective? What's the definition of love? To give. Love means to give. The word, the Hebrew word ahava, comes from the word hav, which means to give. Okay? So love means to give. Giving means, maybe we need to contrast the difference between giving and investing. You've all heard the concept of investing in a relationship? Positive. That's a good thing, right? You have positive associations with the idea of investing in a relationship. Okay, I'm about to explode those positive associations. Okay? Are there any bankers here or stock people? Anybody in the financial world? Nobody in the financial world? Financial world. Explain to me what an investment is. I have $100. Now, tell me what does it mean to invest the $100? What is a successful investment with $100?
You put it forward and it grows.
It grows to?
It grows to something substantial that you
get back. So I put in 100 with the expectation that I'm going to get back 105, 110, 102, depending on the economy, depending on the bubble, whatever it is. But investing means I put in 100 to get back 100 plus. That's investing. Okay? If I put in 100 to have it go away, that's a lousy investment. Okay? So if I invest in a relationship, what does that mean? I'm putting into this relationship in order to get back more than I put in. I've got it. I don't need to put it in if I'm just going to get it back. That's not a good investment. You don't put in $100 to get back $100, although some people a few years ago wish they could have back their $100. Okay? But I'm putting it in to get more. So if I invest in a relationship, I'm giving you in order to get back more than I put in. Is that giving? That's not giving. Giving means I have something and I want to share it with you so that you have it. That's giving. That's love. So the minute a parent is looking at the child as an ego booster for the parent, they're not giving to the child. They're investing in the child. Right? Because now let's go back and read how compelling on one level these words are. But on the other hand, I think we'll hear the Jewish perspective on it in a minute, but to say Chinese parents believe their kids owe them everything. Chinese children must spend their lives repaying their parents by obeying them and making them proud. I gave you, now you owe me, because I gave you. Now, we're going to contrast that with the Jewish concept of kibud av va'em, honoring parents, which sounds like the same thing, but is very different. You wanted to ask them?
I'm having a problem with the diametrically. In other words, either you're a Chinese parent, or you're the lackadaisical parent who just whatever you want to do, sweetheart, it's fine. And the thing is, both of it's like the one is not the opposite of the other. There is a middle ground, which I'm really getting from this. But the other thing is, both of them share the same problem, and that neither one of the perspectives looks at the child as a human being for whose care and whose development I have responsibility. Because in the first case, it's all about you will live up to this standard, or I will shame and embarrass you because simply what I expect of you, and you need me at the moment, so you better toe the line. So the child again is an extension of the adult. Mm-hmm. But the lackadaisical parent also is not seeing up to their responsibility.
And they probably don't see the potential in that child. Okay,
so
I agree.
So one is the opposite of the other. That's and,
okay.
And I'm saying a little bit of that in the sense that, you know, either, even in the American society, you know, I'm hearing the Chinese versus the Americans, and I'm, you know, or the Western or whatever, that we're just all sort of letting our children do whatever they want.
Well, we make them practice.
It's a false dichotomy.
We make them practice flute for 15 minutes, so we don't let them do whatever they want. They have to practice for 15 minutes. But I understand what you're saying. But this is—I didn't make up this dichotomy. The press made up this dichotomy, and the people, because it sells newspapers. But we need to know exactly what you're saying. That what we understand is a balance. But again, it's not a balance that we have both, because you're right. They're both built on the parent. They're focused on the parent as opposed to saying it's my responsibility to give my child education, tools, skills for their welfare according to their individuality. This is the Alpi Darko, and realizing what they really are. So for a parent to say in advance, you will play an instrument and it will either be piano or violin, I think that violates every principle that we believe in of the uniqueness of every Jewish and every human being's neshama, every human being's individuality. Unless I say, no, I need this because this is success and I am being judged by this success. I just want to add a word about kibud av va'em. We brought children into the world. It's our responsibility to educate them. Now, they don't owe us because of that. That's not where Kibud Av V'Em comes from. Kibud Av V'Em comes from the fact that they have life from us. Okay? And that's why we're an extension of the Creator. And God, in fact, if you study carefully the commandment of Kibud Av V'Em, we are vicariously playing the role in this world of some representative of the Creator. And therefore, they owe us life. For the life that they have to respect us and honor us. But it's not that they don't spend their lives repaying their parents by obeying them and making them proud. I'll just give you one simple example in halakha. Kibud Av V'Em, if your parents demand that you marry or not marry a certain person, or they demand that you pursue or not pursue a certain profession, you have no responsibility to listen to them. The halakha does not require you to listen to them when it's going to affect your livelihood or when you think that your spiritual growth requires that you do a certain thing. The halakha says you don't have to listen to them. It's absolutely not true that we spend our lives repaying our parents by obeying them and making them proud. Simply not correct. It's a very self-centered focus. And not the Jewish perspective of where Kibud Av V'Em is coming from. But I agree with you, the balance of, it's, you know, they're both off base, and it's not just to put the two together, but it's a whole different focus on what education means, on what a child is, on what our responsibilities are, etc. Yes, you've been waiting for a while to ask a question.
Well, come on, then. I mean, again, like you mentioned the economy. Chinese also educate for mental health, okay? And we're talking about now.
I don't agree with that. I'm sorry. If you're focused, if the child has to focus on making parents proud, and that's what they're judged on, and that's the standard that we set them to,
it's not a pure thing. And our focus on reifying the child and emphasizing the child's uniqueness and individuality—that's our cultural way of seeing the child.
Excuse me.
Other cultures have a different.
I'm talking about the Torah's perspective. Torah's perspective, we don't believe the Torah's perspective is a culture. We believe that the Torah has revealed to us the nature of children, and that we absolutely, unequivocally believe that every child is unique, uniquely endowed, differently endowed.
Okay.
And that's a fundamental element in their existence because of their divine spark, their neshama, which is unique and different from everybody's.
Okay, so we believe in innate ability. You either got it or you don't got it.
No, what's the it? What's it that I got or don't got?
You've got a nature that is specific to the child.
Yes.
Right? Some right. are to be educated at a certain level, and others are to be educated at another level.
Well, I'd rather use
some
a different...
smooth and...
I'd rather use a different word. Rather than level, how about a different way?
Smooth versus sharp or linear. But the Chinese view of it is, it's not about whether you are born one way or the other, it's how hard you work.
I don't believe. Oh, good. But I don't. You know what? I don't believe that I am going to be an Olympic weightlifter. I don't know how long. I don't think I could ever spend my whole life being it. I am not endowed with those abilities. Okay. I believe that that's correct. And I don't think. And now there's no question that Yitzchak Perlman would not have been a Yitzchak Perlman if he didn't spend 6 or 8 hours a day practicing violin. But there could be another child who would have practiced exactly the same amount of time as a Yitzchak Perlman, and he wouldn't be close to a Yitzchak Perlman. He was endowed with unique talents. Luckily, it was recognized very early so that the world could benefit from a Yitzchak Perlman. But if the neighbor would have looked at that and taken the child and said, "Hey, Itzi can do it, why can't you do it?" and force the child to practice for 8 hours a day, the child would have rebelled.
When I say work, I don't mean in a specific sense. Everybody can work at something where their inclination is.
Oh.
So what happens in our American culture, when we impute a lot to talent to, you know, you're born with it, you know, or it isn't in your nature to learn chess or math or anything else, you know, I don't have a head for it, we abandon that. But if we say it's about if you work hard at something, you could improve, get good, be better. It's about, you know, work versus innate
okay,
ability.
That's
really important in American education.
In Judaism, that's absolutely critical. When we talk about Torah study, we always talk about the struggle, the hard work, the sweat of Torah study. However, let's say with tremendous effort and hours a day, I could probably master chess. Not going to be a grand master, but I'll be very good. But is that the most efficient use of my resources, human resources and talent, when I might have been able to do some other things much easier, much smoother, with much greater facility? So here we come back to the individuality. We've got to know the child and say, wait a minute, why do we want to put a square peg into a round hole? With enough work, we'll get it in. But look at all the lost opportunities if we would have identified what comes, quote, naturally. So, yes, there's no excuse for taking the easy way out. We demand excellence. Excellence is hard work. But let's make sure that we know what we're working hard at and what we're investing, and that the parents, again, coming back to parents, you've got to be devoted, you've got to be invested in the child, not so that the child can pay you back. I think that, to me, the most positive thing that I read in all of this is when she had the math problem, I'm making practice tests, I hand wrote them, and I drilled them with her for a week. That is what we need to be doing. When a child isn't succeeding, we've got to invest our time and our resources and our efforts in helping the child be the best that they can. Absolutely. Are there any other questions? Yes.
So how do you identify the unique ability of the child?
So let me tell you how not to do it. The first thing you got to not do is not look at the neighbor. What was that?
The double negative was problematic. You want to unpack that?
Yes. How do we do it? First thing is we have to stop looking at the neighbor's child. Okay? Because that's blinding us to identifying what our children are truly capable of doing. Okay? So that once we've tuned out the neighbors, right, and the society, and focused on the child, get to know your child. work with the child, care about the child, spend time with the child, have a sensitive ear. Don't try to impose on the child what other people are telling you the child has to do. Okay? And then, a good parent, you know, trust your judgment, trust your instincts. Get to know your child. That's, you know, that's the job. And don't, you know, that you get to know it. If you invest in it and you spend time, you'll figure it out. Anybody that's had children knows that children have different personalities. There are introverts and there are extroverts, and there are mathematicals and there are artistic and there are musical kids, right? And as long as we listen and we open our ears and our minds and our eyes to what is unique about our children, right? The dreaded question that any parent who has more than one child is fearful of. What's the question?
Which child do you like better?
Who do you like best? Who do you love best? Right? Those of you with children had your child ask it? Those of you with siblings asked your parents? And of course the answer is?
You.
All the same.
We love you all the same. Did you? None of you ever gave that answer to your kids? None of you ever heard that from your parents? We love you all the same? How many of you heard that from your parents? We love you all the same. Anybody buy it? Anybody buy that? Come on, give me a break, right? Okay, so what's the real answer? The real answer is yes. But what does it mean to love us all the same? Because we love what is unique about you. But if everybody has to play piano or violin, then by the time you get to the third child, you're in trouble. Okay, we have to identify what's unique, and that's what we love. So what we've got to love is to connect and to really know your child. I'm sorry, wait, there were the two questions over here from a while. Yes.
Excuse me for being a little cynical. I read Amy Chua's article in the Wall Street Journal, and I thought it was a parody of child reading. I laughed at it.
Yeah.
I forgot about that.
Okay.
And over the next week, the fit hit the shams, you know what I mean? It's really, a lot of blog came, a lot of comment came, and people believed what she said. It turns out it was true.
Well, if you read the whole book, whole book tempers a little bit what was in that Wall Street Journal article.
That's my son, Beach Read. That's all I'm saying.
Well, I'm sorry?
It's a Beach Read. It's a Beach Read. That's another story.
Okay.
So, a week after she published this article in the Wall Street Journal, there was a follow-up article in which she admitted that much of what she said was exaggerated and almost fictional.
I wonder whether that wasn't her writing after she, at BC. I'm not sure whether that was in response to the flack that she was taking.
I don't know. I don't know what it was in response to. She probably wrote it to sell books.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, I didn't want to say that, but if you said it, I'll agree.
Very little of it was really true. So the whole Chua model, the Chinese model, to me is a little bit...
Well, okay. I think we're indulging in a little bit of wishful thinking because it almost sounds abusive to us. I'm not sure. It's just here and then in the back. Yeah.
I have a question that's not exactly different types of parenting, but one thing what you were reading that children need to make parents proud, and that's the goal. I don't agree with that goal of how Chinese parents interpret it, but. I also would like to hear your view how to raise a child when you keep giving, and Jewish parents give a lot to their children. How to make them really appreciate that? And
don't give them so much. Don't indulge them so much. Well, why are we indulging our children so much? We have to give. It's possible to give them too much. It's possible to ruin them. It's possible to spoil them. It's a very fine balance to demonstrate, and again, it depends what your motivation in giving them. Are you giving them so they'll love you? Or are you giving them because you want to set a model, you want to set an example of giving and being kind? See, if you're giving so that they'll love you, it'll never end. You have to. It's a very fine balance to discipline and to make sure that they understand that, you don't just give and give and give, and they have responsibilities, and there's what's called in Hebrew hakarat hatov, that you have to educate them to appreciate. But it's all about education. I don't need your appreciation. You need your appreciation. And we have to believe that. And we have to educate towards that. But they have to really understand that you're not invested egocentrically. Because when I say, you know, this is going to hurt me more than it's going to hurt you. No, it's not. No, it's not. No, it's not. It's going to hurt me much more, right? So you've got to have communicated to them that you really are only interested in their welfare.
Well,
and that takes a long time.
All of that, how to instill in them to appreciate their parents best. Because what
yes.
I see, there's issues in many Jewish families, even if you're strict and you raise with love and you want to make them happy, you want
yeah.
to get an outstanding human being. How do you make them appreciate
parents? Okay, so the one word you use,
the
one word that you use there, I think that is going to open the door to the answer is you can't make children do anything. How am I going to make them? You're not going to make them. You will never succeed in making them. Okay, it's part of the education, and you've got to realize that children are rebellious, and children like their independence. And just like we don't like to be beholden to other people because it makes us indebted to them and it compromises our independence, children have the same dynamic. And therefore, your job is to educate, realize that they're not going to implement it right away. And if there's another secret, a rule of education, long term. You've got to be thinking the long term. And you can do things, and that's what the Vilna Gaon also said. I can make demands in the short term because of the power I have over the child, and that's going to just disappear as soon as I lose the power. So you've got to say, you know what? I'm planting the seeds. I'm educating them. I have confidence in my child that they're resistant because of their ego, but they're going to get it and hope for the best. That's what I was going to say. There was a question in the back. Oh, absolutely. That's the whole purpose of the class today. This is not a journalism review. We are talking here about the Torah sources that teach us how to educate children and why. Okay? But there was somebody in the back had a question that yes, I'm sorry, right here. Yes.
Just want to clarify, make sure I understand this. As a parent, you need to give the child the skills and you need to put the time and to work with them and sometimes force them to focus. But also as a parent, you have to notice if they're not doing well, why. See what makes them happy or not happy.
There you go. You're reading right out of the sources. That's exactly what it says. It's flexible. It's sensitive. It's not a one-size-fits-all. You've got to educate. You've got to provide skills. But you've got to know what their personalities are. And they're not all the same. You know, and she made fun of it, but they're not all the same. We believe that deeply. That they're not all the same, and that not everyone is going to be, not everyone was endowed. Now, she makes an allusion to that in one of her articles, and we're not here talking about feeble-minded kids. There can be very talented kids, very industrious kids. They're just not musical. They're just not mathematical. They're just not artistic.
Yeah, my brother, they tried to teach him play the organ. We watched what made him happy and unhappy. After a few months of all the hard work, you realize he's tone deaf. So it didn't matter how many hours
okay.
you practiced,
it's not going to okay. happen. We'll
end with last question. Yes. I think you have to be really good child. It may not be your child. If you look at Anne Sullivan, who works with Helen Keller, and I work with special needs kids, I'm always trying to connect. Maybe you can tell me where the sources in Torah are for this. I try to find the spark in that child. How do I connect with that child, what that child can do, even though they are crippled with cerebral palsy, or they are deaf, or
great.
They are blind, or they can't raise a hand? And it's my job to find out the way to connect with that child so they can be the best, whatever they can be. Not that they have to achieve to my expectations, but they should be the best, and that I, in that moment, can make it a joyous, positive experience for them at that moment.
Unless the article in the Wall Street Journal was a complete parody of everything she believes in, what you just described is exactly the opposite of everything she's been preaching. That's how I see it. I think you're right. What you said now is 100% correct. That's exactly what flows from all of our sources. But what you just said then is that there's a unique spark that has to be identified and nurtured and grown and worked with and given to. I'll use the word invested in the sense that you're investing in that child, not so that you get back, but so that the child can get back more. 100%, but it's not all the same.
No.
Okay, good evening. I hope this was helpful. And we look forward to seeing you in Israel. Join our program.
Okay, thank you, Rabbi Kolinsky.